You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Mitchell, author of The Bone Clocks, published by Random House just 2 weeks ago. And by the way, David will be appearing this week, Friday, at the Free Library downtown to read and sign his new book. It's interesting, the admission fee, as usual, is like $15, $7 for students, but they have a deal where if you buy the book and a ticket for admission, it's only $32, and the book itself is $30, so that's really a good deal. Plus, you get to hear David. So, as far as accolades, David's been called a genius by the New York Times. He's been compared to Nabokov and Tolstoy, but we couldn't get either of them, so we're stuck with David. And here's the thing, too. He was named by Time as one of the most 100 influential people in the world, which was staggering to me, and I thought it was amazing until I realized that he was in the company of Sacha Baron Cohen, Justin Timberlake, John Mayer, who I hate, and Rosie O'Donnell. But to me, it's still pretty cool, and this is the way I look at it. Here's why. Influential means you influence someone, and David's books do that. They influence you. You start the book, and you're a certain person. And then you finish the book, and somehow you're a little different. It's kind of like the Newtonian laws of physics. A moving object tends to remain in motion unless until David Mitchell acts upon it. And this action, the story we're telling that David has told, is a story that's told over a span of decades through a woven protagonist, Holly Sykes. And through that skein, she's further woven with other characters who are as real can be. And in the book, we discover an eternal battle between good and evil, two forces each battling for immortality, one for good, one for evil, primarily with a few slips here and there. So back to our world. Our world is just our world. And then when you read the Cloud Atlas or the Bone Clocks, you've kind of been wobbled a bit. So David is the author of The Thousand Autumns of Jakob de Zoet, Black Swan Green, Cloud Atlas, and many others, including the acclaimed The Reason I Jump. He's the translator there, which is a story of autism kind of from the inside out. So, David, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and that was quite an introduction you gave. Other people may wish to put me in the exalted company of Tolstoy and Nabokov, etc. But I wouldn't dare to elevate myself to those heights. But thank you for your high opinion of me, and I'll do my best to write work that won't disappoint you.
Okay. Well, like I said, I have tried calling them several times, and I would have gotten them. So, first, I always do this. What a great cover for your book! Did you pick it out? Did you vet it? Did you have anything to do with it?
I would like to claim even a gram of credit for it, but it was pretty much a done deal. I'm allowed some initial input, and because I'm not a book jacket designer, that's usually wisely ignored. And then at the very end, I'm allowed a presidential veto. But when I saw the artwork from Random House for The Bone Clocks, I did not want to use my presidential veto at all. Quite the reverse. I loved it. I'm really happy with it.
The reason I always ask is because I own an independent bookstore, and as many times, and it's, you know, which is difficult to do nowadays in America. It's a labor of love. And the reason I ask is because as the owner of one, and as many times as people say to you, you can't judge a book by its cover, everybody who comes into my store judges books by their cover. And I think that's why publishers leave authors out of it. It's like a chef in a restaurant can't be the manager of the restaurant. And you're the author, but they want books to sell. And I think they're very smart the way they do their covers. And I think this one's really great.
Oh, it's really beautiful. I guess there are authors out there who are also superbly gifted graphic designers, but there's probably not many of us. And I do know I'm not one. So and such a great art department at Random House. Generally, I've always left them to it, and I've never been disappointed.
Oh, the other thing is cool that, because you're like Nabokov and Tolstoy, you don't need blurbs on the back cover, which you hardly ever see in my bookstore.
Oh, that's almost embarrassing. They're great immortal writers who will still be read, I believe, 300-400 years from now. And if I'm still being read 30 or 40 years from now, I'll be really happy. That's enough for me.
But it's really cool that you're not blurred, because it makes the back cover look so pleasant, you know?
Yeah. It is a shame to overlay words of eager, gushing praise onto a beautiful piece of art. I always feel a little bit sorry for the artists who put their heart and souls into artwork, only to have it sort of embossed with superlatives about the author. I guess they're used to it, but it is nice when that doesn't happen, and when hopefully the book can
stand on its own.
On its own merits, and maybe the reputation of the author as well. But reputation is a fickle thing, of course, and it comes and goes, and it's good not to take things for granted.
Well, before we started, I said I tend to blab a lot, and blither whatever, blather. So make sure you stop me.
So not at all.
The first question I have, I guess, am I a bone clock? Are you a bone clock?
Yes. Unless you've done a secret deal with a shadowy circle of immortals that promise you that your relationship with mortality can be renegotiated, then yes, you are a bone clock. It's a rather disparaging term that people who are onto a way to outfox death have for the rest of us who age, and they see from our faces how much of a time that we have to live in our lives has already gone and how much is left. So it's a form of disparagement.
Well, you know, it's funny, it's like the bad guys here are taking shortcuts to achieve immortality. The good guys, well, partly unwittingly, but they do it the right way. And this is like what we were talking about before we started, which was how you like to almost, I guess, immerse yourself in something rather than go to Wikipedia and cut and paste it into your book. You know what I mean?
Oh, I wouldn't want to do that. I think, right, readers are very clever people, and they know when a cut and paste job has been done, and I wouldn't want to insult their intelligence by letting them think that I thought I could get away with it. And anyway, where's the pleasure in that? The pleasure in writing is in realizing an imaginative world and putting your heart and mind and soul into it and making it work and making it real. And cheating not only sort of cheats the reader in the way you suggest, but it also cheats yourself. It deprives yourself of the best part of the pleasure you get through hard work and through hopefully good work.
And I think that translates with, like you said, I think it resonates with the reader because readers are smart. You say making it real, and here's something people have asked you, and you kind of make fun of yourself in the book where you talk about, a book that's half fantasy is like a woman who's half pregnant. And yet your book is, I wouldn't say half fantasy, but...
Yes, I know what you mean, yeah. That was a cheeky line of mine when I'm having my cake and eating it too.
Yeah, you were.
It was actually, I need to credit that line with to Lana Wachowski, actually, one of the directors of The Matrix and also the Cloud Atlas movie. I was describing the story to her and I heard myself say, well, it's kind of a half fantasy, and she just responded by saying it can't be half fantasy any more than the book could be half pregnant. But in a way, the novel's made of six different novellas. One of them is out and out full on, if you're going to take Vienna kind of fantasy. It's a war between two groups of people who are able to bend the laws of physics in ways that we aren't. However, the other five novellas that make up the novel, with the exception of a few sort of precursors of the war and a sort of coda of the war as well, with the exception of those, they are actually not fantasy. They're written in the realist mode. One is political, one's almost military, and then there is a sort of pastiche. The future one's a kind of a future dystopia after oil's more or less depleted, set in the 2040s. So, in a way, yeah, the book is actually only 1/6 fantasy and 5/6 not. So I get to use Lana's line and kind of bend it a little bit as well.
Well, what's cool, and I do like a lot of science fiction and fantasy, is that the reader is kind of fooled in a way, because in the beginning with Holly Sykes and the disappearance of a particular person, you only get these slight intimations in the shadows that something more is going on that really meets the eye. It's, you may be really reading a thriller or a mystery, but then out in the corner, it's like when you look out of the corner of your eye and you see something, like Pink Floyd, you know, like Comfortably Numb. You know, you see something.
I know that line. It's a great song.
Yeah. Yeah, what is it?
When I was a child, I caught a fleeting glimpse out of the corner of my eye. I turned to look, but it was gone.
I can't tell you, you would not understand.
I know too much.
It's funny because I went to a boarding school like that, and I remember in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a young man, he goes to a boarding school like that, and in the frontispiece, how he writes James Joyce, or he writes Stephen Dedalus, and then he writes Earth, Solar System, Galaxy, and that's the way I always felt it. You know, like you start, you know, inductively, you know, from the smallest part all the way to the outer part, and that's kind of what the book is like too. It's like kind of a miniature that gradually becomes this giant conflagration between these two incredibly strong forces.
I like that metaphor very much, Sam, and with your permission, I'll recycle this in the future, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's funny. You know what's so much fun, and I imagine it was fun for you, is writing about the near future, because you're able to make it the same world we're in, although more so, like when you talk about Justin Bieber's fifth divorce.
Yes. You can have lots of fun with the near future. There's enough clues and enough evidence in the present. You can see trends and you can continue them and sort of and extrapolate curves over the next maybe 20 or 30 years in a way that you can't really do over the next 200-300 years, where you do have, on the one hand, you have more of a blank slate, so you do get to make everything up and you sort of have less, you're less beholden to the present. But on the other hand, it is a blank slate, so you have to do that, so you don't get any help from the present. The near future is an interesting place to write about, most certainly.
Yeah, and once again, that goes towards, well, is this real? Is this fantasy? Is this the world I live in? Is it the world I live in 2018, which is, being my age, happens in a flash, in a moment. Hey, did you ever own a Sinclair ZX81?
I did own a Sinclair ZX81 and then a Sinclair Spectrum.
Spectrum.
But only a 16K at first, because I couldn't afford the 48K on my pocket money.
I know. I remember when I bought my first 20 meg drive that sat underneath my Apple and it cost me $400. Now you'd have a thumb drive like that and you'd throw it in the trash can.
Our science and technology, it is superb at computing power, miniaturizing things, kind of at the nanoscale. And of course, it's still fueling the whole show, pretty much, with the exception of nuclear fission, which has other problems of its own, on kind of a 1940s technology, coal, oil burning power grid. It's sort of this fact that I sort of extrapolate into the 2040s and just speculate, well, what will happen when the juice is out, when the juice runs out, when there's no more oil, to the rest of it, because it seems that our godlike standard of living is, well, not for all of us, but for the more fortunate few in the first world, is resting on Apple-type technology, microtechnology, nanotechnology, which is nonetheless founded itself on something much older, dirtier, and unsustainable.
It's funny because the converse is also true when you think about the fact that between 69 and 72, we went to the moon 6 times on technology that's now contained in the guts of a iPhone, a new iPhone 6.
Yeah.
But what happened? Other than Elon Musk, there isn't much going on.
With interstellar exploration, you mean, or interplanetary exploration?
Yeah, I mean, shouldn't we have gone? Yeah. I mean, we were using vacuum tube technology, and shouldn't?
I think in the visions of the future that nourished our boyhoods, we never factored in economics. We never factored in. It was built on wonder, utopianism, and perhaps some idealism that hasn't really made it to the 21st century. When we were thinking about the future, we didn't imagine shareholders or an accountant in the background saying, well, what can we do to make all this pay? This is all well and good, but who's going to pay for this, and how are they going to get their money back? Whereas I think this is a reality which space agencies in 2014 the world over are, of course, having to confront idealism and just pushing back the frontiers of science for its own sake is not actually that compatible with the neoliberalist ethic about, well, yeah, but how's it going to pay for itself?
Yeah, but, you know, once again, you know, and you, Ed Brubeck, who I think is kind of you,
well, they're all kind of me, but some more than others. But don't let me interrupt you, sorry.
That's all right. Authors don't like to talk about what I'm about to talk about. But it's like, you know, I was just reading about how Iraq, with the interest, is going to cost us $6 trillion. You could go pretty much anywhere you want it with that. And your views of Iraq, I mean, I've never known what an evildoer is. I've never known who possesses weapons of mass destruction other than us. I don't know what a spider hole is. And I don't know what it means to bring people to justice, as W would say. And I don't know why April Glaspie told Saddam, hey, go ahead and invade Kuwait. We don't care. It's your business. And Brubeck is like that. Those are my point of views. Are they your point of views, or are you interested in talking about it?
about the Iraq War?
Yeah, just about, what Ed Brubeck says. I mean, it's such a logical way of describing it. And when he's at that cocktail party, or no, at the wedding.
Wedding, yeah.
Yeah, he realizes he's gone too far, which I do at every cocktail party.
Well, yeah, I think my views would to a certain degree coincide with my character Ed Brubeck's. You notice I'm being tactful and diplomatic.
Of course you are.
I am aware that there'll be people listening to this program who will have served in Iraq, and they have knowledge and angles and experiences that I don't. And so it does behove me to be somewhat cautious and respectful of what they've gone through, and to just make it clear that I'm not saying that my version of events in Iraq is the only valid one. It is the one that the knowledge and the arguments and the logic that I have access to add up to being sort of the view that I hold. I'm not being terribly coherent there, but
no, you can leave it be.
Yeah,
you can leave it be.
Okay. I would agree with much of what Ed Brubeck says and thinks and believes, but of course, reality and truth are complex, multiplex things, and anybody who tells you otherwise, they're bad news. Watch out for the demagogues. Watch out for the simplifiers, because as often as not, it turns out they have your hand. They have their hand in your pocket.
Yes, as political
one way,
system,
one way or another.
Yeah, and that's what politics and religion tend to do. It's really funny too, because when I was reading when Ed first appeared, I'm thinking to myself as a reader, because maybe I wasn't reading as closely as possible, I'm thinking, Ed Brubeck. Wait a minute, who is he? And then so I'm flipping pages backwards and backwards and backwards, and it took me a while.
Oh, yeah. And then I go, so you worked it out?
Yeah, I worked it out. I thought I was an idiot for not working it out. But then when I did work
Not really. I meant to wrong foot you, and I'm happy rather than irritated that you didn't work it out at first, but I'm also pleased that you worked it out in the end. Yeah, he's a boy who Holly meets when they're 15 during her long, strange weekend that the first novella in the Bone Clocks describes. And, of course, you think he's just one more passing character who you won't be seeing again, but then a couple of novellas on, you get to realise that he's got a much larger role in Holly's life than you were led to believe at the time. But isn't that how life works? Isn't that how reality works? Sort of, the person you end up maybe falling in love and having kids with, even first time you met them, first few times you met them, perhaps the first 200 or 300 times you met them, you had no idea what was in store for you in your joint shared future.
Yeah, it's kind of like also like that movie Sliding Doors, where you know you just happen upon, whether it's a woman on the beach writing things in wood, or whether it's Ed. And what's so funny is one of the presages is reading a particular postcard in a room, and I'm saying, I wonder who that postcard is from, and why is he? And then you talk about Mr. Lamb, who is one of those people I said, maybe there is some good within the bowels of evil, and he has that pure moment. There's this pure moment, and that pure moment somehow survives everything, doesn't it?
It does, and it's really important at the end. This is a straight lift from Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities, really. The same thing happens in that. There's a character who in the 19th century parlance would be a complete wastrel, a cad and a bounder, but he has the potential for one good deed that happens in the end. Evil in and of itself, good in and of itself, are quite obviously Manichaean concepts, and in a sense not that interesting. Evil's only interesting when sort of you can see the motivations inside it, and these terms, good and evil, they're a little bit comic book, and I'm a little bit distrustful of them. I think it's the novel's job, one of the novel's job, to actually look at what's motivating the evil, and if you like, see it from its point of view. The more carnivorous immortals, they would say that, hey, we're only trying to do what everyone else is trying to do. All we want to do is survive, and we have a way to do this, which is sort of, which is not in the normal way of things, but nonetheless, what's the difference really between this and a heart transplant operation, or what's the difference between this and eating meat? So I do try to sort of endow the antagonists in the novel with a kind of ideology that justifies what they're doing from their point of view. That then becomes interesting. That becomes something that the reader can think, well, actually, if I was one of them, then how would I view things?
Exactly.
I think that's more interesting than just sort of daubing in a black and white sense the evil doers and the more angelic side and the more white side as well. You can see them from a somewhat different point of view. They can be fairly pitiless when it comes to making the sacrifices or obliging other people to make the sacrifices that have to be made in their feud, in their war. I'm not quite sure where that answer came from. I think I just answered a question you didn't actually ask.
That's okay. Those are the best answers, I think. But, it is funny because, that you do use the metaphor of Hugo when he's doing a certain thing that is naughty, that it's like he's pulling the legs off a spider. Which is about as bad as you can get. But at the same time, there's something else pulling him from within. And it's like what I was saying at the beginning, not to get you more of a swelled head than your tour will get you, but the reason why, that's what I'm saying about being influential. The reader has, you know, when you're giving the book to the reader and you're kind of saying, okay, you guys figure it out. And so what happens is, yeah, you're looking at these guys and you're saying, you know, does that make sense? Are they justified? And it's like when I said, I don't know the definition of an evildoer. Are they justified in doing this? Are the bone clock people doing anything different? And so for good or for bad, you leave it up to us, don't you?
Well, I like books that do that. I like books that treat me like an adult. I don't like books that deliberately mystify me, and I certainly hope I don't do that. And I hope I provide sort of the tools in the novel that readers need to open it up and see how it works and think about it. I hope the novel is a kind of a conversation between me and the reader. I hope it's an enjoyable conversation for the reader that he or she feels a part of. I don't like being lectured at by novels. And as I say, I don't like ones that deliberately try to mystify me. So all writers are readers as well. And of course, we're greatly informed by the readers that we are. And so I just try to write the kind of books that I'd like to read.
Which would lead me to ask you a question about the ending, but I'm not going to. And how come I'm in love with Holly Sykes? Are you in love with her?
Yes, I am, rather. I think at some level I need to be to sort of animate her. She needs to be someone you care about. She's the glue between all these disparate pieces of the novel set in different decades at different eras, different stages of her life, from being a teenager through to being a young woman in her 20s, to being a mother in her 30s, to being a reluctant and unlikely writer in her 40s. The 50s is a fantastical section that's too bonkers to even get started on, through to being a grandmother in her 70s, about 20 or 30 years from now in the west of Ireland. These are distant and disparate parts, and Holly's the glue that keeps them together. So if it's not likable glue, then the book's in trouble and I'm in trouble. Also, she doesn't know she does this, but she's the sort of person that when she touches your life, she inadvertently shows you the slightly better, maybe nobler human being that you could be. Some people take her up on this offer and become that. Other people don't. But she has to be a likable and someone in whose inherent goodness you believe in for this to be credible. So there's a number of reasons I really had to get her right. Of course, she's a flawed person as well, like all of us. She's no saint and she makes mistakes and the rest of it. But on balance, I need the reader to be rooting for her. She is, of course, the novel's most important character. It's her life.
Yeah, no, I just finished reading The Light We Cannot See, and there's a character in it, and she says, everyone calls me a hero. She goes, I'm not a hero. I just get up in the morning and live my life, don't you? And the other guy says, And the other guy says, no, I don't. I used to. And
oh, what a great bit of dialogue.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, Do I get up and live my life? I wish I could say yes.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not yes or no. Maybe it's do the best you can as often as you can. Of course, life is not a self-help manual, and of course, it's messier and more complex, and we get tired and short-tempered and impatient and worried, and it's not you can't walk around being an enlightened Zen monk the whole time. It's just unless you're squirreled away in a monastery in the mountains in Japan or something, we have to make compromises, and the universe will make a thundering fool of us from time to time. But that's part of the course. You can't change what happens to you, but you can work on your attitude to what happens to you. Gosh, this is getting quite deep for this time of day.
Well, no, that makes me feel better about myself, so I'm glad you answered it, because I'm not such a jackass after all.
Oh, well, we are all jackasses. We always will be. And the more we think we're not, you can guarantee the more we will be. But, what do we do with our jackassery? How do we respond to our jackassery?
I guess it depends on whether you're an idiot as well.
Do we try to contain it? Or,
I never
or
have.
Do we let it just control our lives for us in an untrammeled and rather miserable way? You just have to do the best you can, don't you?
And I think the bottom line is, if you want to be nice to people and you want to do good, it pretty much trumps all the jackassiness and the idiocy.
It does. Yeah, it does. It does. Just I think about this a lot as well. But yeah, just I try to be a better human being year by year as I am. And you can kind of mark some progress down the years, I think. Sometimes sort of an argument, another pointless argument is about to flare up, and you think, actually, no, I'm not going to respond to that. I'll just let that one go. It doesn't really matter. Being nice is more important than being right all the time.
I just did that last night.
Good for you.
And also, you know, the other thing, and I bet you might do it too, is now when I write one of those flaming emails that I write in response to something, I just put, I just put it in the draft folder, and the next minute I wake up and delete it.
Yeah. Never send an email when you're angry. That's a really good rule of thumb, I think. Almost always regret it. And actually, sort of, don't make decisions when you're angry, and don't make judgments when you're angry. You're not really yourself when you're angry. You're certainly not thinking straight. So don't quite trust yourself when you're angry. There are times when it's necessary, and times when a short burst of anger can actually get something done and have a positive effect. But if you can, always use it with a cool head.
Except for someone like Christopher Hitchens, who, you know, was constantly angry, but it worked.
I'm not sure if he was. I think it was... I don't think someone that angry, that genuinely angry, can be that eloquent and that laser-guided. He did supportable righteousness. I mean, and I would have felt the same about many of the things he said, and many of those eloquent evenings that he where he kind of held court, which you can now peruse at your leisure on YouTube.
Yeah.
But I think there was a certain amount of theatricality involved in his anger, which actually, therefore, is not anger at all. It's a superbly acted angry human being. But this isn't to sort of disparage his integrity at all either. It's just he was a great, great orator and communicator of ideas, and he used any means at his disposal to meet that end. To meet those ends, including the persona of the righteously angry man.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, another author is like Stephen Jay Gould, who did the same thing in terms of, hey, this is not religion, this is coincidence. And he did that all the time. But I wanted to bring up something, because I just read this book called What We See When We Read. And I thought about it, because what do we see when we read? So, like, in my mind, I have a vision, albeit somewhat blurred, of what room 119A looks like.
Right.
But I don't know what it looks like. Do you know what it looks like exactly?
I have a vision as well. I'm deliberately a little bit vague about the exact address of the place, but I've walked past it here in Manhattan a few times and looked up at its windows and wondered. That's the magic of reading.
Yeah.
These little squiggles of ink on pressed vegetable matter that we call a book, that these can act as a conduit from my imagination into yours. And it doesn't matter if what is in my imagination doesn't correspond even too closely to what's in your imagination. That's a beautiful, mysterious, wonderful thing, and books and reading are a beautiful reason to be alive that the behaviour of our species would sometimes suggest we don't entirely deserve. But thank heavens it's there.
So look, I'm thinking of, like, here's how I do it. So if you think of The Raven by Poe, I think of this guy who's totally depressed, sitting in a chair with his hand kind of like lank, and in it is a glass of some type of brandy, and he's looking at his mantelpiece, and the room is gloomy and the damask curtains are drawn. So what do you think of that room?
The imagination builds scenes. It designs sets like you would do if you're making a film, and the exact nature of the set, because it's prompted and triggered by the words on the page, but you bring your own experience as an avid reader. You bring your own experience to that set building, to that act. I apologize, I just had to answer the hotel door there. And it's a beautiful alchemy that can link us with people who were born and died 1,000 years ago. Reading's just a miracle, isn't it?
It is a miracle. It's, you know, and if we go back to Tolstoy, I mean, here's this guy, and you're reading it now. Oh, here's a story. This 12-year-old kid comes into my bookstore, and he wants to buy War and Peace. He's 12 years old. And I couldn't sell it to him. I had to give it to him. There's no way a 12-year-old who wants to read War and Peace should have to pay for the book.
Oh, here. You wonderful independent bookstore owner. I hope your shop exists forever. You paid a small service to civilization when you did that. I hope someone did that to you in your past and that you're passing it on. And I hope if that kid becomes the adult that it looks as if he might, he will also provide the same service to someone in the future, because it's more important than money, isn't it? Good on you. Good on you, Sam.
You're welcome.
Look, this is rude, but my publicist is making signs in the background, and this conversation is a pleasure. I'd like to speak with you all day, but
I know, me too.
I've got a packed day in New York today. I hope we get to meet. Would you be able to come to the library event at all?
I'm going to try to come to the library event, but I may be, because of where you're staying, I'm almost going to make reservations at the Empire Hotel on Friday. But hopefully I'll be able to get both of them in. And if not, when the book turns paperback, maybe we can talk again and spend some more time together.
I'd enjoy that, Sam. And it's been a real, this has been a very nourishing conversation for me. So thanks for being such an attentive and avid reader. And look forward to when our paths next cross, okay?
Likewise. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you too, Sam. Okay, bye. You have a good day now.
You too. That was David Mitchell talking about the bone clocks. And as both of us said, not to pump myself up, but it kind of does. I mean, I could have spoken to him. We didn't even talk about the book, and I always feel bad about that. But I could have talked to him all day long. What a great guy, and what an incredible, incredible author. If you haven't read The Bone Clocks, which you probably haven't because it just came out this month, you know, there's just so many books. I mean, Cloud Atlas and Black Swan Green, just to start with. And then once you get going, you won't be able to stop. And he really is a true influential person and will be on your life as well. I can't say enough about him. And please go see him at the library this Friday. And I feel bad because you might get to see him, and I think I'm going to be out of town. But in any event, I would have loved to talk to him some more. So next week, a completely different thing, Ellen Cooney is going to be here. And she's going to be talking about the Mountaintop School for Dogs and Other Second Chances. And I was so sick of dog books. We have tons of dog and cat books in the store, but this isn't that. It kind of explores the psychology of dogs at the same time. It, you know, there's dogs that are damaged for some whatever reason. Their parents, their master and mistress abandoned them, or they're greyhounds who have been taught to chase a cloth rabbit and are totally berserk. But in this case, it's set against a backdrop of a woman who is hurt in the same type of way, and the book shows how each can heal the other. And so it's not really a book about dogs. It's really a book about how love and how understanding can heal horrible wounds and at the same time, in this case, bring animal and human being together in a way that's feasible, logical, and can actually happen. So again, I mean, I'm so happy about the Bone Clocks. And join us next week on The Avid Reader when we talk to Ellen Cooney about her book, The Mountaintop School for Dogs and Other Second Chances. So, The Mountaintop School for Dogs and Other Second Chances. Thanks as always.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.